This is OTB AM.
On this morning's OTB AM.
This is only football, but the matter of public health is of a far bigger concern, and the decision wasn't made by LASK, who lost €1 million, and they were put under incredible pressure. And I don't think anybody criticised the club. It was a decision made by the Austrian government. So people understand the reasons why. And two or three Manchester United fans managed to get themselves inside the ground and make themselves heard, which was appreciated by Ole Gunnar Solskjaer when he was asked about it after the match.
Join us on Monday morning from 7:30, where we'll bring you all the latest sports news and analysis.
OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show, weekdays from 7:30 a.m. only on OTB Sports Radio. Live 24/7 on the Go Loud app. The OTB Podcast Network.
The Football Show on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
I'm prepared to do anything I can.
Well,
to
do it then.
Country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should it be an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Now you're welcome along, Football Show. Later on we'll talk to Kenny Cunningham. He's watching Manchester United put together a very nice performance against Brighton. They're 2-0 up. Mason Greenwood with the first goal. Bruno Fernandes via a deflection with the second. It's about to go half-time. United have lost their last three matches against Brighton in the Amex Stadium. That is the kind of period it's been for United, but they're in good form at the moment. That midfield three is working, and Greenwood alongside Rashford and Martial causing Brighton lots of problems. Aaron Connolly up top, largely on his own, is having a fairly miserable time, it must be said. So Kenny will talk to us about all of that later on. But in the meantime, Dermot Corrigan from The Athletic joins us. Good evening, Dermot. Thanks for your time.
Hey, Joe. Good to talk to you.
So Barcelona kicking off as we speak against Atletico. Things have not been good there for a while, and certainly since the end of the lockdown. They did re-emerge with a two-point lead over Real Madrid. That's quickly been eaten up, and they find themselves 2 points behind Madrid. A draw against Celta Vigo on Saturday, 2-2 draw. Madrid managed to beat Espanyol. And there is, well, really, reports of doom everywhere.
Yeah, it's not been good for Barca. It's been a difficult season for them all the way along. You know, they sacked Ernesto Valverde as coach in January. Then there's been rows between senior players like Lionel Messi and sporting director Abidal. Then during the lockdown, there was rows again with the board over cutting the wages. And since they came back, they won their first game pretty handily. But since then, it's not gone well, and they've been dropping points, particularly away from home. While Madrid, without playing particularly well, have won all their games. So usually, there's normally one of the two big clubs is in crisis, and at the moment, it's definitely Barca. And Madrid look well on to win the league, and Barca, who knows what's going to happen over the next couple of weeks.
There are more widespread problems here, bigger problems here ultimately, and then there are the specifics of this current situation. So look, the fall guy here is going to be Quique Setién. We'll get into the bigger picture since 2014. You were writing about that in The Athletic. But Quique Setién, he took over in January. He replaced Valverde. He came from Real Betis. He was very much talked about as somebody who was in the mould of the Barcelona philosophy and passing football, and a fan of Cruyff, and said lovely things about Messi. And
yeah,
there were reasonable hopes, actually, he would do something, that maybe this was a guy who just hadn't been given a chance at a club like Barca, and somebody with that vision of the game, it might click, it might work. It hasn't. What are the complaints against Setién?
Yeah, well, if you are a true believer in the Barcelona way of playing, what some people thought was, if we get the right coach in to organise the players, it doesn't even matter if maybe the players are not as good as they were before, that once they play the right way and they pass the ball well and they position themselves well on the pitch, it's going to work. But the reality is that it just hasn't really worked. That Setién came in, talked a great game, said about how he was going to organise things and teach the players new things. That didn't go so well. You know, they got knocked out of the Copa del Rey almost immediately. They lost at Valencia. And he's had to go back and do, you know, what Valverde was doing before, which is play more pragmatically. A lot of the players are getting on. Their best players are still Messi, obviously, is still their best player. Then there's Suarez and Pique and Busquets, who are still quite good, but they're not, physically, they're not at the level that they were before. So it's all, what Setién came in kind of sounded good, and, you know, in theory, you know, might work, but with the current squad of players, it's just impossible. So he's had to rein that in. Results haven't improved, even with the way that he's playing more cautiously. The results haven't improved, and now they're neither playing good football or getting good results. So people are looking for people to blame again.
And inevitably, the grumblings from the dressing room kicked off and leaked out. So they felt he was, what, too hands-on in training, certainly initially, and his assistant coach isn't too popular either?
No, definitely not. Eder Sarabia is a bit of a character. He's a, you know, at previous clubs he was very much liked, but he's somebody who both him and Sedian have very fixed ideas about what they want the players to do. And Sarabia is even kind of hands-on. You know, at training he put his hands on somebody, go, okay, you go there, and he shouts at them. He says, get over there. You know, you have to do this. You have to do this. And for at other clubs that has worked, because they were very interested by the ideas and were players who maybe thought that they could improve by following the instructions of the coaches. At Barca, it's quite different. You know, people like Suarez or like Messi especially, Busquets, these guys, they're not too happy about getting shouted at. They're not too happy about getting told to do. They expect a level of respect. And, you know, whether it's right or wrong, you know, a coach should, in theory, be able to organise his team the way that he wants to. But when results don't go your way, then they start looking for people to blame. And if he wasn't that really popular, as it is, weren't that popular anyway, then it's easy to turn around and to blame the coach.
If Real Madrid go on to win the league, as looks now increasingly likely, he gets the chop in the summer, I presume.
Yeah, there's already talk, and this will be harsh on him because it's not really his fault, but they're playing Atletico tonight. Atletico are in great form. Were things to go wrong tonight, and again at Villarreal at the weekend, and Villarreal are also in great form, and they're pushing to qualify for the Champions League next season. So were Barca to really go badly in those two games, it's possible that Sedian would get sacked immediately, and that Barca B coach, Garcia Pimiento, would be asked to take over the team for the rest of the season. That's difficult then as well, because they've got the Champions League coming up as well. Barca are still in there. It's going to be difficult for them, but they still have a chance. So everybody kind of hopes that, you know, whether to sneak a win against Atletico, I'm just checking on the TV here, whether to sneak a win tonight and then to pull things together, even if they don't catch Madrid in the table, that it would be enough for Sedian to go on. The other problem is that it's not so obvious who's going to come in to replace him, because you know, they looked around for other coaches in January, couldn't get anybody then. Everybody knows how difficult the position is institutionally, financially at the club. There's, you know, a kind of a reckoning is coming down the line. And if anybody had, you know, ambitions to go in and be Barca coach and put in a long-term project, it's going to be difficult until that kind of reckoning happens.
Just looking at the teams this evening, so Messi starts, Suarez, Vidal, that's a front three, Rakitic is there, Busquets is there, Pique is in the centre of defence, Alba is there, Ter Stegen. Against Celta Vigo, it's a 2-2 draw. By all accounts, Barca were pretty good the first half, or maybe even the first hour, maybe as good as they've been under Setien, and then just wilted very badly, and the equaliser was coming. Suarez scored as well. Like, were there any, did they take any comfort in that? Were there signs of progress within that? Or is it still just, way off where they need to be, that they're being caught like that by Celta Vigo?
Yeah, it wasn't. They were in control of the game. Celta are in a relegation struggle themselves, and they had rested a lot of players because they were targeting a game they had tonight against Mallorca, who were also down at the bottom of the table. So a lot of Celta's best players weren't on the pitch at the start. Then kind of the way the game went, it looked like the Celta coach said, we're going to throw them on now, especially with the five subs, and have a go at Barca in the last few minutes and see what'll happen. So when Celta sat back, it kind of suited Barca. I guess they weren't under that much pressure and they scored two good goals. But when Celta really had a go with them, they started to crumble, really, Barca, and the changes that they made didn't help. So there were very few crumbs of comfort being taken from the result. Like, Celta's a difficult place to go. Barca don't have a great record there, and things haven't been great for Barca all season. So it wasn't a huge surprise that they drew, but it's just because of the situation that it is, and because it's all coming down to these last couple of weeks in the Liga. Anytime you drop points, it's trouble. And with the current situation, the critics were ready to pile on.
And they have dropped points away from home in particular. Just 6 wins in 16 games on the road. Nou Camp form is still pretty good. Where they're playing tonight against Atletico, 15 wins out of 16. So look, that is the specifics of this mini crisis. And it's been, you know, it's just been brewing there all year behind the scenes. And Sedian will meet his inevitable end soon enough. But like, the big picture is what you looked at in your piece at The Athletic. And it is the bigger talking point here. And you make the point that really, if you go back to the summer of 2014, that's probably the last time that Barcelona really strengthened. So they spent 165 million, you wrote in your piece, and they signed Suarez, they signed Ter Stegen, and they signed Rakitic. All settled in pretty quickly, all made a difference to the team, and they won the treble that year, Champions League, La Liga, Copa del Rey. You then outlined the following seasons, and it is quite staggering, really. They spent more than 800 million, 800 million on new players, and we could go through the various years. But the short version, the short conclusion, of the 800 million, it's hard to say they've bought a single success story.
Yeah, it's been amazing, really, and it was interesting to go back over it and to just look at the different windows and outline just how much money has gone. Barca used to be able to sign, like, the best players in the world wanted to come to Barcelona. That was the deal. You know, you have people like Thierry Henry or Cesc Fabregas or Mascherano, David Villa, who are actively going at their former clubs and going, I need to get out of here, and, you know, putting up a fight to get to go to Barcelona. More recently, it's been like they've signed a lot of younger players who have promise. They've signed players who they think will do a job for them to fill in. But as the mainstays of the team, your Xavis and Iniestas and everybody has, Dani Alves have moved on. The people who've come in to replace them have just been not of a similar standard at all. And the guys who they've made bets on hasn't worked out. Like some players like Coutinho, Dembele, even Griezmann, they're all good players. It's not that they've, you know, been signing people without any reputation at all. But for whatever reason, it hasn't worked. They haven't been good fits, or the way the club is set up, the way the team is set up, has not been ideal for them as players. And it's just been very difficult for them. Just looking at the DV here, Barca have scored. It might have been an own goal at a corner. Messi put a corner into the near post. So it's 1-0 to Barca on live here.
So 2016, 125 million was spent on several players. Umtiti, the only one, for instance, who was playing against Celta Vigo on Saturday. 2017, Neymar went to PSG. So that's 200 million coming back in, which is significant, we should say, of the 800 million. That summer, Barca spent 375 million. Dembele, Coutinho, Paulinho, Nelson Semedo, Yerry Mina, Delafeo, and Marlon. This season, 273 million spent. Griezmann, Frankie de Jong. You would still hold out hope that things might go okay for de Jong in the long term, and a couple of other players as well. Who's dictating things now? I mean, who's pulling the trigger on the signings? Who's identifying the players? Like, does the manager hasn't felt like an especially strong figure there for some time? Have we had consistency even behind the scenes?
No, that's a big thing that was interesting to look at as well, is that the big transfer window that worked for them, you know, back in 2014, they had Zubizarreta, the former Spain goalkeeper, and Barca goalkeeper was the sporting director, and he previously had worked with Guardiola and now was working with Luis Enrique, who were two former teammates of his. They saw the game the same way. They were able to, the coach could kind of say, this is what I need for the team. The sporting director could go and look at it, and the money was there to sign the players that were identified. There was a big row then between Zubizarreta and the president, Bartomeu. Zubizarreta got fired, and Barca went on and won a couple of months later after that, Barca went on and won the treble. And I think the lesson was taken there that, you know, Zubizarreta wasn't really that important. That, you know, even when he was fired, we went on and won the treble. So we don't particularly need him. So different people have come in to do that job who've been lower profile people who have come and go. Some of the directors have got involved in transfers. There's people who are general managers, chief executives. Raul Sanai, who's at Arsenal now, had an influential role as well in the transfers. And there's so many different power groups at the camp now as well. There's always a little bit of feuding going on between different directors, who's up and who's down, and which player is associated with which director, and who is signed. And, you know, even some of the guys who they signed, you know, there'd be like five suits in the photo when they'd say Arthur Melo is signed from Brazil, and everybody's really happy and they want to be in the photo to identify him. Now Arthur's being sold to Juventus this week to try to fix a hole in the finances, and those guys are nowhere to be seen in the photo. So there wasn't you know, when Zubizarreta, he has his critics, and, you know, I'm not saying that every decision that he made was correct, but at least there was a philosophy there. There was a clear line of who was making decisions. It went to the coach as well on the bench to try and get people who the team needed, and that's just not been there over the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, you just can't get away with it for 5 years. Maybe we're seeing the culmination of that now, not least when the star power is aging. So with Zubizarreta gone and this mess behind the scenes, that's all obviously been exacerbated by the fact that you spend 800 million, you're going to be short a few quid, and the financial situation, it's pretty dire, isn't it? I mean, COVID maybe has exposed that more than we all realised.
Yeah, it's a bit like the people who are going, I'm not sure who originally said, but people are going bankrupt bit by bit, and until it all happens very suddenly then, that, yeah, they have been doing a bit of of patching up the accounts every year. Like the Neymar sale was very important, and even last year they had to make sure that they brought in 100 million or so in sales in order to balance the accounts for each financial year. And this year again, it's up to 124 million that they have to bring in. And it, you know, it's difficult sometimes when you look at the accounts of clubs because it's so complex. And even you can, Barca's accounts are on the internet, and you can download it. There's like 100 pages to go through, which is a challenge. But basically, they have spent too much money, even though they are the richest club in the world and they pay the highest wages. The money has been out of control, and they've been trying to catch up, to sell players, to bring money in each summer in order to fix the problems that they made before. Now that COVID has happened and that you know, revenues have dried up to such a significant extent, that's no longer possible to do. It's very difficult to keep filling those holes, and they are in a really difficult situation for sure.
How have Madrid been since return to football, Dermot?
Madrid have been not shining too well, but they've won all five of their games, which is pretty good. They've been a very functional team. Even before earlier on this season, they were very tight at the back, or in most of their games anyway. In La Liga, they were tight at the back, and they weren't scoring too many goals, and that's kind of continued.
It is quite something that Zinedine Zidane is one of the most pragmatic managers at top-level football, isn't it?
Yeah, like he seems to have taken a lot from his time in Italy when he was at Juventus and worked under Lippi, and even with the French national team, they always had a strong core, and you know, people like Makélélé around him to do the work for him. You kind of wonder whether Zidane, the coach, would pick Zidane, the player, or whether he would be too happy to have him in the team sometimes.
Well, I do remember as a player famously when the Galacticos thing got out of hand and they sold Makélélé, he said, "We've just sold the engine of the Ferrari."
Yeah.
So maybe, I mean, before, you know, it was there before our eyes that he was cognizant of that. Obviously, he was just such a glorious player. It was maybe less apparent.
Yeah, he's obviously a very intelligent guy. And because he didn't speak so much before he came in as coach, and even now he's not, you know, doesn't do lots of interviews and go around bragging about what he can do. But he knows what's important for the team, and he's big into the work ethic. He talks a lot about how, you know, if you train day to day, and if we work as hard as we can, and we run as fast as we can, we give everything, then, you know, we have Madrid, we have the best players in the world here, we have guys with amazing quality, and at some stage we're going to score a goal in the game, rather than putting together a super plan, as Setién maybe would do, or Guardiola, or somebody to how to unlock the other team. It's more about working hard, trying really hard, and then allowing the individual quality to out and for them to score goals. And you know, it's not brilliant to watch. It's not dazzling really, but it's been very effective. And at a time like now when there's games every 3 days and players are a little bit tired, and you know, everybody's just getting to deal with the difficult situation at the moment, it seems ideal way to kind of grind your way to a Liga title.
Well, they're grinding, and they're 2 points clear, as we said, before this evening's game at the Nou Camp. Madrid have come back and they've overtaken Barcelona, so they're 2 points clear after 32 matches played. Effective or otherwise, managers playing that kind of football don't exactly tend to do very well at Madrid. Now, his legendary status, I suspect, means he has a lot of credit in the bank, and the job, you know, what he's actually won gives him further credit in the bank. But are there grumblings amongst Madrid fans? I mean, they can't be getting out of their seats all that much.
Yeah, it's been an interesting season, really, because it hasn't been, you know, it's been far from a great season for Madrid. If Barca had been at the level of other years, you know, they would have come back from the break 10 points clear, and we wouldn't have been having the conversation at all that we had earlier. Madrid also, you know, one of their last games before the break was to lose at home to Man City to Pep Guardiola in the Champions League. So the second leg of that is still to come. But generally, it hadn't been far from a top season for Madrid. What matters most to Madrid is winning the Liga title, really, and winning trophies. That especially Barca have won a lot, maybe 7 of the last 10 La Liga trophies Barca have won. So to win a title is going to be pretty good for Madrid, no matter how they do it. Long term, Zidane, when he came back into the job, he talked a good bit about a plan that he had to build a new team. You know, the idea was to move out the guys, maybe people like Gareth Bale, James Rodriguez, even some of the older guys in the team, and get Pogba and Mbappe, build a new team. That hasn't really happened yet. He got Hazard, who hasn't sparked. So whether there's full faith in him for a long-term project, we'll have to see. But, you know, compared to the worse things look at Barca, the better they look at Madrid at the moment. So Zidane is pretty happy.
Yeah, and it's not like he's not doing an extraordinary job. It's just at that club in particular, you have to do things a certain way. Sal Niguez, by the way, has equalised for Atletico at the Nou Camp, so it's 1-1 there. Dermot, we'll be watching with interest over the next couple of weeks and reading about it in The Athletic as well. Thanks a million.
Cool. Thanks, Joe. Always good to talk.
Cheers. Dermot Corrigan there, whose work, as I said, you can read in The Athletic. So 1-1 between Barca and Atletico this evening. Halftime report from Richard Newman at the Amex.
Half-time, it's Brighton 0, Manchester United 2. The visitors in complete control of this game. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's side looked good from the start and they took the lead after 16 minutes. Mason Greenwood opening the scoring with a fine individual goal, cutting in from the right and firing low past Matt Ryan. And Bruno Fernandes doubled the lead, a slight mishit on the edge of the area, but scoring low down to Ryan's left. He actually had a better effort about 15 minutes earlier than that and it hit the post. Brighton have a lot of work to do to get back into this. They haven't shown a lot so far. It's Brighton 0. Manchester United 2.
There we are. Second half just getting underway. We're going to chat to Kenny Cunningham. Amongst other things, he's been watching that game.
The ads start now. Paddy Power sponsors the Off the Ball Football Show.
Kenny Cunningham, you're there. Hello.
Far too long, Joe. Far too long.
I agree. Now, listen, there's a few things I want to talk to you about, but we've got some important business to take care of first here. Point of order. We've got to start with this. Don't hang up, Kenny. Don't hang up.
Whose birthday is it?
Everybody, Kenny Cunningham. It's the big 5-0. Happy birthday, Kenny.
Oh, Joe. You want to do your research a bit better than that, lad.
What age are you saying, Yar?
Well, it's not my birthday for a start, and you're a year out on top of that. So
don't pretend.
I don't know which is worse.
No, don't be hanging on to your 40s like that. Come on. Fess up.
Thank God this is recorded, so you can actually edit this out.
Oh dear. Come on, be honest. You're 5-0. I saw that 49 business doing the rounds. I'm not having that.
I must be wrong that I was born in 1971. My mum must have told me the wrong day then. I blame her.
Dear. Okay, well listen. Let's get down to less important business in my opinion.
Please.
But interesting nonetheless. I want to go over to Richard Newman. Keep listening, Kenny. There's been another goal at the Amex Stadium and a good one at that.
Brighton and Hove Albion 0, Manchester United 3, a sensational goal from United. Actually, Brighton had started this second half fairly well, but it was a counter-attack from Manchester United. Up the left wing, Mason Greenwood put in a cross, and Bruno Fernandes was there to hammer a volley past Matt Ryan, his second goal of the game. It's Brighton 0, Manchester United 3.
Yeah, 3-0, 55 minutes on the clock. Did you see this goal, Kenny?
Oh, the brilliant counter-attacking goal, Joe. Matt is released. It was Greenwood down the left-hand side. You're just seeing the qualities of the United front three. This is the second time now I've seen this front three in action. Martial, Rashford and Greenwood, and they're breathtaking at times. Three of them so athletic, powerful kind of running machines, and a high level of technical ability with it as well. I mean, Greenwood shares about 40 yards full pelt there. Joe got to the edge of the box and still had not just a composure, but a technique to get his head up and just floated to the back post. For Fernandes, who must have run full pelt 50 yards to make the box, and you just never expect him to miss, Joe. I mean, he's only been there a short period of time, but technically so good. Even a volley coming out of the air, you just thought goal. It was a brilliant goal. Brilliant team goal.
Greenwood was fantastic. I mean, he's kind of vintage. I think Gary Neville on Sky, you know, drew a comparison with that goal they scored in the Champions League against Arsenal. Just length of the pitch, lightning quick, that kind of a goal. Greenwood scored the opener. I mean, he's not on the scene that long, obviously, but in some ways it's a kind of a trademark Greenwood goal, you know, and it puts a defender on the back foot, doesn't need much backlift. No. Just makes scoring a goal at senior level very easy.
You're right, Joe. I mean, he could end up being the best of a lot of them, you know, Rashford and Martial. You consider his age. If you look at his physique, Joe, he's a strong boy, he's tall, he's got that athletic build. He even looks physically, he looks a bit stronger. Even his muscle definition, looking him up close on the box, and his technical ability and just how he carries himself, like so calm. And you mentioned it there, just in terms of never gets flustered in front of the goal. His goal tonight was brilliant, kind of double step over, knew exactly what he was doing, he dragged it inside the near post. And it's one of the reasons I think I give Solskjaer a huge amount of credit. There's been a lot of noise last kind of maybe 6 months here about United having to spend big, got to bring in a top class centre forward, Harry Kane, spend the money, etc. But I haven't quite seen it that way, because very early on, and you've mentioned it there, I haven't been the only person, you've looked at that Greenwood very early in his career and thought, oh, this lad could be something special. He just needs a little bit of time, but most importantly, he needs game time. He needs to get on the pitch and play games. So what are you going to do? Are you going to spend $100 million on a centre-forward to bring into the football club and park this lad on the bench for a year or two and stunt that actual development? Or are you going to say, no, I'm going to keep me checkbook in my pocket and I'm going to commit to this young kid over the next kind of 12 to 18 to 2 years? And hopefully that's what Solskjaer is going to do. Because already, Joe, in a very short period of time, you're looking at this kid and thinking, wow, this kid could be absolutely sensational.
Because so many times a young player arrives having scored bags of goals at youth level, and United fans would have heard of Greenwood doing this. And then you would have seen it, I'm sure, with players coming through. Just it's that bit harder to score at senior level, that bit harder to score at the elite level. He seems to pick off very simple goals. They're very good goals, but he makes them look quite simple.
It does make them look simple, Joe. You're absolutely right, and that step up, like you said, some players, young players, struggle with it, never quite make that step up. Some of them, it takes them a longer period of time. You really have to be patient with them. But this kid, like, he's never let me down, Joe. I've never seen him play for an extended period of time in a Manchester United jersey and thought, you know, I'd be disappointed there. He hasn't been able to get into the team. He's looked a little bit out of sorts. You know what I mean? Every time he gets on the ball, he seems to make the right decision, never flustered, and has that real kind of cutting edge. Plays the pace, the game almost at his pace. You know, just kind of slows it down when he has to. But he's got a real turn of pace as well, Joe. Anytime I see him open his legs up over 30, 40 yards, he's quick. He's a powerful runner as well. And this is why United supporters have got to get a bit more excited, and they have been of late, because the top end of the pitch and in central midfield now, that partnership of Pogba and Fernandes, that front five now, Joe, it's as good. I mean, I know, you know, don't be getting ahead of ourselves. He'd be saying, oh, it's only like, you know, a couple of weeks, a couple of performances back to back. But the potential there in that kind of front five is absolutely awesome in terms of goals and assists.
Well, so I take your point about not getting too far ahead of ourselves. But sometimes things just click and they look right. And, you know, that initial impression that it's right carries forward. Like, we had Damien Delaney on over the weekend, and he was saying, no, he just doesn't see it. And, like, you know, so to kind of summarise what he was saying he doesn't think you'll get 20-plus goals a season out of Rashford. He doesn't think you'll get 20 goals a season out of Martial. Greenwood, OK, promising, but no more than that at the moment. Pogba, jury's still out. Luke Shaw doesn't fancy Luke Shaw. Is not sure about either of the centre-halves. And Bissaka's final ball is improving, but needs to improve further. And the goalkeeper is going through something approaching a crisis. So I think only Bruno Fernandes emerged unscathed from the general summary. He was saying, like, for him, he said City and Liverpool obviously will probably still be favourites to be 1 and 2 next year in everybody's book. Yeah. But he was even saying, like, Chelsea are ahead of United and will be ahead of United next year.
Yeah, I think they could be close, Chelsea. Chelsea are making great strides forward. I love the look of their team as well. But I wouldn't agree with him on what he said in terms of the Manchester United front line, because it's not about, like, this kind of who's going to get the 25, 30 goals. It's all about the total number of goals at the end of the season. You're seeing this in the modern game. It's all about the total. We're seeing the top teams, the front three. You know, it's not about centre-forward getting 30 goals and your wide men chipping in with 5 or 10. Liverpool are the greatest example of that, their front three. You know, 20 goals consistently, every one of those players. And I think potentially that may be the way it'll be with United. I think Martial's capable of between 15 to 20 goals. Rashford 15 to 20, Greenwood 15 to 20. Absolutely, I agree, in terms of Fernandes and Pogba, for me, they could be the most lethal attacking partnership. By attacking partnership, I mean in that midfield three, those two advanced number eights. Manchester City play that way with David Silva and De Bruyne. Liverpool play that way, whether it's Henderson or Gini Wijnaldum. But these two lads are potentially could put numbers together to actually blow those players out of the water. Fernandes and Pogba, for me, could chip in with 30 league goals between them and 20 to 30 assists, absolutely. Pogba, the argument that Pogba can't score goals for me, I mean, I'm sure we've all seen enough of Pogba. When he disciplines himself and keeps himself higher up the pitch and gets himself involved in the edge of the box,
I mean, it's ridiculous what he can do. He did it tonight. He set up Fernandez as an assist straight away for his goal. The more he commits himself to getting to forward areas of the pitch with that hole in midfield, and if I was Matic, I'd be screaming at him to get up the pitch, get away from me. Sometimes he actually gets a bit too deep, Pogba, to receive the ball, and he's such a great passer of the ball. I can understand it. A couple of times he found Fernandez high up the pitch, smashed the ball 20, 30 yards into Fernandez's feet, which he can do. I'd actually like Pogba to receive the ball off Matic 15, 20 yards higher up the pitch and actually go and look and to make play those little combinations with Fernandez and the front three a little bit higher up the pitch. Those front five, almost play your own game a little bit higher up the pitch. Split the whole team into two. Your whole midfielder, Matic, in the back four, and then that front five. Just give that front five the ball almost and let them get on with it. Because that front five, for me, can produce absolutely frightening numbers.
Yes.
I take Damien's point in relation to defensively. I think their issues there probably haven't been spoken about too much. Maybe they're actually short one top-class defender. The amount of centre-half they have, but in terms of an outstanding partnership, I'd agree with him there. De Gea, to a certain extent, has find that consistency which was there some time, but I think he can do that. But for me, from an attacking point of view, Manchester United absolutely breathtaking potentially what they could achieve. And I still think there's room probably for one more, Joe. They've been linked with Sancho in the papers this morning. For me, I could see that type of player, more a versatile player who can operate off maybe both flanks, maybe another one of them coming in to the team just to supplement what they already have. But the structure, that not so much the structure, the backbone of the team, for me now, you're looking at it, and it's almost breathtaking from an attacking point of view in possession of the football.
And neither of us obviously know what's going on with the Paul Pogba situation or his intentions staying or going. But
What
you can certainly say is, certainly in comparison with even a year ago, he's now looking around the place and he's got a manager who seems like a decent man manager, and even just body language on the pitch, he must look at Fernandez and then what's ahead of them, and he must start to think, this kind of suits me, this kind of fits.
Oh, absolutely, Joe. That type of player, Pogba, in terms of the quality Fernandez has brought to the team, he's got a player now who he can really trust with the ball. He can give him the ball, he'll protect the ball, he'll give it to him back. He's got that individual ability, that little bit of a hint of arrogance to him that Pogba possesses in abundance. And he's got players up the pitch now who he can use as well. He can find them over the top with the pace that they have. And also, they're a high enough technical ability that Pogba can actually go and play with them. You always sense previously with Pogba, he was looking around the pitch thinking, really, this is good as United have got. I mean, almost do I have to play with this lot? They're not good enough to be on the same pitch as me. That's kind of how arrogant that he is. But he probably had a small point to a certain extent. Well, even his body language, you said it there, Joe, even this evening, he's high-fiving Fernandez a couple of times. He's got a spring in his step. You know, his shoulders are back. He's really enjoying his football. And that's going to be important. That's going to be key to keeping him. Champions League football would certainly help if they were to make that by the end of the season. But actually being in a team where he's really enjoying his football, he's linking up with people, you know, even that for me is going to be integral in terms of where he's going to commit himself. Because if he doesn't, it'd be a massive blow. If it doesn't, they're going to have to just take the money and go and reinvest it as quickly as possible. There's a couple out there for me, but it's got to be paramount to try and keep Pogba. Because in this system that they're playing at the moment, in the area of the pitch where he's operating, I can't think of one offhand who's going to improve Manchester United if he comes out of that team. So the Solskjaer has got to be doing as much as he can. I think he is the moment just to convince him, look, your future's here. You can achieve things here. Potentially maybe not the next 12 months in terms of a league title, but very quickly in the next 2 to 3 years, this team can certainly compete for a league title and the big prizes in Europe.
I presume a difficult reason for both Aaron Connolly and Shane Duffy for different reasons.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Aaron, he would have known that before he even stepped onto the pitch. I mean, they started a kind of 4-4-2 system, which is fair enough, but just maybe just a little bit too passive for me. I mean, it doesn't matter what system you play at times from a defensive point of view. If you're a little bit too passive in that system, you don't spring out and look to engage people and kind of force errors, you know, you're just going to be sitting like chasing shadows for most of the game. And they're very, very passive for us kind of 20 minutes of the game. It was difficult for Aaron. He tried to stretch his legs a couple of times, but found it difficult to make an impact. So, you know, I wouldn't be overly critical of him whatsoever. And obviously Shane's finding it difficult with the type of quality that we're talking about, United high up the pitch, because change of positions is good. Rashford's comfortable coming on the inside. Martial will float out onto the left-hand side. Greenwood plays on that pocket on the inside right, allowing Wan-Bissaka to get on the outside. The interchange of positions is really good, Joe. For a defender, it's not easy. Your concentration levels have to be good. Your decision-making, you know, when to pass him on, when to stay with him, you have to get it right time and time again. So not easy for Shane in the heart of that defence.
I don't know. I presume you've been on. I've been off the last couple of days. Have you been on the station since Liverpool actually officially won the league?
I popped on for a couple of minutes with Nathan. I think it was after the Chelsea game,
yeah.
Joe. Yeah, he was on with Stephen there, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, we've been talking about Liverpool for a long time now and almost talking about them as champions for a long time. It has been the most extraordinary season. As a one-off season, and they could still get to 109 points if they keep going the way they're going. Like, it's up there as about the best Premier League season across the however many games that we've seen. I mean, it's in the same bracket as the Invincible season, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's been breathtaking. It really has. And I was pleased to see him kind of pick up where they left off. A little bit, I wouldn't say I was sore against Everton first game back almost. It was kind of understandable. The Crystal Palace game was good. They were more like themselves, you know, in terms of the tempo, kind of that kind of aggression, that direct style of play, you know, was more of what we've seen for the majority of the season, was really impressive. So, yeah, I mean, there's nothing more you can say,
no.
Really, Joe, to be honest with you. Like, even like speaking to Nathan that night after they'd actually won it, I felt as if there was almost nothing to say.
I know, it's hard to do it justice. I know, it's like, this is the moment, say it. And you're like, well, look, I said they were brilliant last week.
And the month before that, we've been saying this since kind of November, December, and early next year when we knew the title was over. So, yeah, it was a bit of a strange feel. I'm just very just interested kind of going forward now for me, Liverpool. A lot of talk about listening to the old ex-Liverpool players is kind of very interesting. And it seems to be a general theme in terms of, well, this is the time to strengthen now. Go out and buy now. Mm. You know, we should have gone and got Wenger, et cetera. We've got to get stronger. This is the time to invest. And I understand that logic to a certain extent. A lot of the time I think, yeah, I can understand that. But this is probably one of the very few examples, if only example, when I'm looking at Liverpool team and squad and thinking, do you know what? He doesn't need to spend a penny. He doesn't need to spend a penny from what I can see. Because as long as Klopp is assured that the kind of play, the focus is still there, the hunger is still there for these players to go out and chase back-to-back titles and go and chase another Champions League and grab as many trophies as they want, that kind of intensity is still there, which it seems to be, Joe, from a distance looking at it. Mm. You feel as if they want more. You know, they want to create a dynasty there. They want a 3-4-5 year period of success, league titles, Champions League, the whole lot. And as long as that's the case and Klopp gets a sense of that, I don't see where the new players come into that. I just don't see where the air is in that team. The starting 11, let alone the squad, where he needs to bring anybody into that squad. Somebody needs to tell me what player,
well,
what area of the pitch they need to invest in.
Yeah, let me throw one at you. And Jamie Carragher started this conversation a couple of months ago, and I thought it was interesting. And he was saying, he talks to a lot of Liverpool fans, they're there every week, they're watching the games. The one player they might be prepared, like top player, they might be prepared to swap out for a decent chunk of change is Salah. And he was saying, it was funny, he did a really good piece. He was saying he's about underappreciated and overappreciated. Like, he's had an iffy-ish season, but his numbers are still really good. He was, on the other hand, and he plays most games, he's available most games.
Yeah.
We'd Pat Nevin on last night, and I was just saying, if you were Klopp and you're sitting before the committee and they say, "What, you know, we've got you the goalkeeper, we've got you the centre half, what do you need next?" Pat looked at Salah this year and felt he looked tired, just off it, just that bit tired.
Yeah.
And can they get away with that for another season? So he was saying he would get another top player to be in that front three. Now, you risk upsetting the mood in the dressing room, I would presume, is the other issue.
And get rid of Salah and get another player in. Is that what you're saying? Or keep Salah?
I got the impression Pat was saying try and keep Salah and try and keep them all happy and there's enough games.
Yeah.
Carragher was saying maybe you could cash in on him now, I felt.
Yeah. Well, the only reason for me, the only reason I could see it, Liverpool spending big in terms of a top-class forward, big money, would be in that eventuality. Obviously, they lose one of those front three for whatever reason.
Mm.
That's the only reason you go and invest 75 to 100 million on a player. I mean, the Tino Werner, for one, just for me, just didn't make sense. Any top-class forward coming into Liverpool, I just can't see it. What does Klopp say to a top-class forward coming into Liverpool when he sits them down, him and his agent down to the table, they've agreed a fee of 70 million, and that player, save his team of earners, sits down with Klopp and says, "Jurgen, where am I going to play?
Yeah.
What does he say with those three? You don't even ask that question. You know before you even go into the football club, I'm not going to play here.
Mm.
Those three are guaranteed to play every single game when they're fit. So I don't see any top player actually willing to go and sign for Liverpool in those circumstances.
Mm.
Now, I take Pat's point in terms of Salah, a little bit of a drop-off at times last season. Physically, didn't seem to be moving around the pitch. I'd certainly agree with that. It's the amount of games he's played, though, Joe, the last couple of years has been absolutely phenomenal.
And Carragher made that point. He said, like, the one thing you underestimate is this guy's almost always fit.
Yeah, and his numbers, Joe, it's not as if we last season were looking back and thinking, yeah, well, only 8 goals and a couple of assists, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, his numbers are up there on top of that, and if he can get a bit of a bounce back next season in terms of physically and getting himself back up to the level where it's previously, you know what I mean? Well, watch out. So I don't see that. I think he has Klopp's confidence personally. Like, I don't get a sense of Salah that he wants out or somehow his relationship's broken with the crowd. So for me, I don't see that type of sign. All Liverpool need are players to fill in for those players who are happy actually to sit in the bench. Nobody's happy to sit in the bench, but who will accept it and who are good enough to come in and make an impact if they're asked.
Yeah.
And that's what Origi does. That's what Minamino's going to be asked to do. Even Oxlade-Chamberlain can play in a wide area if need be. The young boy Harvey Elliott, potentially a young kid I know. But these are the type of players he needs to have around the club. Players who are actually going to be prepared, Joe, to play a bit part. Good enough to come into that team and make a contribution, but also realise almost their place, Joe, in terms they're going to have to sit on that bench and suck it up every time that front three are fit and not be a problem, you know, not be one who, you know, who kind of, you know, just, you know, carries himself around the place with his chin on the floor and happy not being in the team, upsetting the kind of the balance of the squad. You can't have that. And that's a problem you have if you bring a top-quality striker in who wants to play and who's almost demanding to play and not happy to play.
Mm.
You can create your own problems. So that's why I'm saying this is one of the very few occasions where I think in Liverpool's position, I'd advocate actually not spending. Not spending unless they lose for whatever reason. If somebody bangs on Klopp's door and says, I want out. Maybe Naby Keita goes into his office in the summer and says, Jurgen, it's been great, but I need to play. I want out. I want to go and play somewhere. Klopp might say, well, fair enough, I'll let you go, and he might have to go spend and replace him. But at the moment, if all of those players are totally committed going forward and are desperate to be a part of it, I don't see where he needs to spend money in any area of that team.
Yeah, very interesting. You get the impression, looking at the soundings from the club, he's thinking along similar-ish lines, actually.
Yeah, I heard a few comments from Klopp today in terms of spending money. We have to be a little bit creative. I don't know whether that was a case maybe the money wasn't there or a case where he might be alluding to that. I don't really
I think
feel
he's talked a few times about how, with the COVID situation, they don't actually know how much money they have to play with. They don't know what the revenue generated this year is going to be. Like, that was his reasons, that was his rationale behind the Werner decision not to go for him.
Yeah, but then again, like I said, the very one didn't make sense to me. Like, for maybe that young kid would have been happy to go there, earn 150-200 grand a week, and sit on the bench. I can't believe that 24 years of age, the level that young fella was playing.
Yeah.
He wasn't astute enough, or his agent wasn't saying, Timo, not too sure we want to make this move.
Yeah.
I mean, that front three, where are you going to play? At least in Chelsea, you can see where he can go in. He's versatile. He can operate off both flanks, even down the centre. You can see there's kind of game time from a Chelsea. That kind of makes sense, Joe, from the Vale. That Chelsea one always made sense to me ahead of Liverpool.
Mm.
You know, I just can't see any top-class player. Now Sancho's been linked there and et cetera, et cetera. I just can't see it. I just can't see any player. I can understand somebody maybe potentially say that the boy Havertz, Bayer Leverkusen, I've seen a lot of play, outstanding player. But he's a different type of player. He can operate in a midfield three. So he's different. He's not one who necessarily has to play across the front line. So you could accommodate him in the team with that Liverpool front three. And you could make an argument, potentially, he could improve Liverpool in that middle three area. In 2 years' time, maybe Henderson's getting to that age. Gini Wijnaldum, to a certain extent, this guy Harris, is, for me, is absolutely top class in terms of the type of player that he is, goal scoring threat, physicality, technical ability. So for me, maybe that type of player in a year's time, if you were thinking, maybe if I lose Keita, for example, who can I bring in? Havertz, for me, would improve and would actually make them stronger, having him there rather than Keita. So that type of thing in the future I can see, but certainly not at the moment, and certainly not across that front line or even the defensive line, Joe. It's hard to see. Like, that Neco Williams has done great for him, isn't he? Young kid at right back. He looks a great option for me if anything happened to Alexander-Arnold. You know, they got options there at centre-half if Lovren's happy and Matip are happy to sit there. and spend enough time on the bench. That may not be the case. Lovren may go to Klopp again and say, look, my age, I want to play now. You know, it's been great. I've loved it, but I want to go. So then he might have a decision to make in terms of spending a little bit of money in terms of backup. But so strong all over the park.
No, fair enough. You've argued the point well. Next season is shaping up very nicely with those four anyway. Kenny, the clock is against us. I'll let you go and watch the last 15 minutes of the game. And happy birthday again.
Oh, you got that massively wrong. I hope you're absolutely embarrassed.
Life begins at 50. Life begins at 50.
No work whatsoever. This is what happens when you do no work yourself. You rely on other people for information.
Right, go on. Good luck.
Good luck. Take care.
Bye.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. It's not quite a TikTok lip sync of Donald Trump, but it's a close second. Gamble responsibly. See Dunlewy.net.
Welcome back. We were talking Barcelona earlier on the show. It's half time at the Nou Camp, 1-1 Barcelona and Atletico. Elsewhere, Mallorca 5-1 winners against Celta Vigo, and Sevilla about to beat Leganas 3-0 this evening over in Spain. Meanwhile, at the Amex Stadium, 10 minutes to go. United have completely emptied the bench, as is their right these days, and it's 3-0 against Brighton with 10 minutes to go there. OTBM back with you tomorrow morning. Gerard Nathan speaking to Derry manager Rory Gallagher. Very much a club-orientated situation up in Derry. So we'll talk to Rory Gallagher, see what he makes of the club v county situation, which is ongoing at the moment. Graeme Hunter also with the lads, presumably talking about that Barca game and the title race in Spain generally. Tomorrow night we're back, 7 o'clock. Eamon Coughlan will be on the show. We will check in with Andy Mitten as well, and there'll be Wednesday night rugby. And as ever, do download the new app. OTB Sports is the thing to search in your app store. Richie McCormack is on the way after news headlines.
Get my ball and he out of grass. I'll give you a move for the perfect pass. Ball and he had a spice. He'll give you a move with guiltly grace.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.